Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, lending support to generations of farm families. Whether a young farmer or a seasoned grower, Farm Credit Illinois offers financial products and services geared specifically to the agricultural community.
Land of Grand University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. This is the Closing Market Report. I'm Todd Gleason out of the office today, so this is a special holiday edition all about weeds and weed control. Coming up, we'll hear about a four-step program for controlling weeds in both corn and soybeans. That with Aaron Hager, weed scientist from right here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois.
This Stock and Commodity Report is made possible with support from Bates Commodities and Normal. Bates Commodities can be reached at 1-800-383-4647 or on the internet at batescom.net.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Let me take a moment as we get started for this day to remind you about some of our online programming and how you may use it over time. As you know, since 2003, University of Illinois and WILL have been posting Commodity Week as a podcast. It may be one of the very oldest podcasts on the planet. We're very proud of that. You can always pick it up and all the rest of our programming online at willag.org. That's willag.org. There you can look in the podcast section, or if you prefer and you just happen to use iTunes, search for either Closing Market Report or Commodity Week. You may be even able to search for my name, Todd Gleason, and you'll find the podcast there. You can listen to these programs online on your computer, on your phone, whether it's an Android and or a iPhone or other device that can connect to the internet of any type, including your iPad and other kinds of pads. So make sure you visit our website at willag.org. That's willag.org. All of our agricultural programming is posted to the content sections there not long after it airs on our radio stations. It's just part of the service that comes to you from Illinois Public Media. We've been putting this program together in its current iteration since 1985. It's all about farm broadcasting, commodities, and commodity prices, along with weather. So pick it up right there at willag.org. Again, the web address, willag.org. Do it right now. Do it online. Do it at your own convenience. For this 1 week, we'll add a regular feature to the Closing Market Report. We call it trading terms. Our term for the day is futures contract, or just futures. It is a standardized contract between two parties to buy or sell a specified asset of a standardized quantity and or quality for a price agreed upon today, the futures price, with delivery and payment occurring at a specified future date, the delivery date. The contracts are negotiated at a futures exchange, which acts as an intermediary between the two parties. The party agreeing to buy the underlying asset in the future, the buyer of the contract, is said to be long, and the party agreeing to sell the asset in the future, the seller of the contract, is said to be short. While the futures contract specifies a trade taking place in the future, the purpose of the futures exchange institution is to act as the intermediary and minimize the risk of default by either party. Thus, the exchange requires both parties to put up an initial amount of cash, the margin. Additionally, since the futures price will generally change daily, the difference in the prior agreed-upon price and daily futures price is settled daily also. That's called variation margin. The exchange will draw money out of one party's margin account and put it into the other so that each party has the appropriate daily loss or profit. If the margin account goes below a certain value, then a margin call is made, and the account owner must replenish the margin account. By the way, the Chicago Board of Trade listed the first ever standardized exchange-traded forward contracts in 1864, which were called futures contracts. This contract was based on grain trading and started a trend that saw contracts created on a number of different commodities, as well as a number of futures exchanges set up around the world. And that's the definition of futures contract.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason out of the office today. So no regular update of the commodity markets. Recently, I spoke with weed scientist Aaron Hager about resistant weeds and how farmers might be able to control them in their fields. He has a four-step plan for both corn and soybeans. It's posted to the Bulletin website. You can find it at bulletin.ipm.illinois.edu. Let me repeat that for you. It's bulletin.ipm.illinois.edu and look for four-step plan. Now let's talk about that plan with Aaron Hager, weed scientist right here on campus. Aaron, give me some details on this plan.
One of the significant concerns that we have with weed management in 2016 is though really revolves around systems that still continue to try to rely on a single tool or tactic. And the unprecedented weather challenges that many in Illinois experienced during 2015 really highlight the fact that we may have every good intention about making a very timely post-application in corn or soybean, but reality of it is nature really holds all the trump cards. And if that's the only weed management approach that we're going to do in our cropping system, what 2015 showed us really highlighted the perils of doing that, because in many of the fields that we observed across the state, that weed management, this post-only approach was not applied in a timely manner because of wet field conditions. It was pretty easy to look at these fields and determine that yield loss had already taken place by the time that that post-application had taken place. And so what we're really trying to get folks to consider is that what we do in managing weeds does not increase your yield at all. Everything that we do to manage weeds effectively tries to preserve that inherent genetic yield potential of the hybrids or varieties that you've elected to plant. Weeds do nothing to increase yield. All they do is they function to reduce crop yield. And so by a good integrated management program that keeps the ability of weeds from actually reducing that by competing too long with their crop, we're actually allowing that crop to express that genetic yield potential that most farmers look to and decided upon, this is the variety, this is the hybrid that I want based on its yield potential. If we don't invest in a very sound weed management program, it's very unlikely that that high-yielding hybrid or high-yielding variety is ever going to be able to express that genetic yield potential if the weeds are allowed to interfere and compete too long.
This is about cost-cutting measures that producers might try to deploy next year, and really about the balance between preserving yield and improving your potential for yield.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to considerations that farmers are making right now in areas that they may try to reduce expenditures going into 2016, we certainly understand the reasons for this. There are many different ways that you can go about reducing your weed control or your weed management costs, but we simply caution folks to not trim too deeply or too much when it comes to your programs in 2016. Partly because in many fields that we saw this year, there's been a huge return of weed seeds back into the soil seed bank. So many of the populations, weed populations that we'll encounter in 2016 are going to be very, very dense. So we're putting forward the idea of consider your investments in weed control or weed management as simply that. It's an investment. It's not necessarily a cost that you do not receive a return from. The investment in adequately managing weeds in either corn or soybean pays itself back in full at the end of the year with more bushels in the grain cart during harvest time. And we've actually run through an example of a scenario that I think is a real-world scenario that if a farmer, say, in a soybean field elected not to use an integrated program, they decided on a post-glyphosate-only weed management program, whether or not the farmer knew or accepted the fact that the water hemp in the field was resistant to glyphosate. And so the idea would be we'll only use glyphosate post-emergence. Well, if you run through some scenarios and some numbers, if you look at, say, a fairly modest yield loss of, say, 20% due to season-long interference of the water hemp, if you look at a soybean yield potential in that field of 65 bushel to the acre at $9 soybean, you can do the math yourself, and all of a sudden you realize that by trying to save a little bit, maybe cut a little bit too deeply in your weed management program up front, at the end of the year you actually lost well over $100 an acre because of the yield loss that occurred in that field because you simply could not manage that weed population, or you allowed that population to compete or interfere with the soybean crop for way too long.
In the second part of the series, you take up resistance, why it remains, and then some about post-application herbicides.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the issues of resistance that occur not only in Illinois but in many other states in the Midwest continues to grow each and every year. This is not something that, you know, the weed scientists at universities are making up to try to, you know, scare people into change. This is reality. This is happening. And we see this more and more frequently throughout the last 10 to 15 years here in the state of Illinois. If you look at the sheer number of samples that have been submitted this year in 2015 to the University of Illinois Plant Clinic for resistance screening, there was over 1,700 samples submitted this year. And even though we really haven't put the data together yet to look at how many of those actually tested positive for resistance, if you simply consider the sheer number of samples that were submitted this year, that strongly suggests that this problem of resistance is not going to go away, and it's not. And also keep in mind also that it's just not the most significant issue that farmers are going to be facing with resistance. It's not just the resistance in, say, water hemp to glyphosate, but rather what happens when water hemp plants or populations begin to accumulate resistance to more than one herbicide. And so if our plan, if our strategy for 2016, well, I'm going to continue to grow a glyphosate-resistant soybean variety, and all I'm going to do is I'm going to tank mix glyphosate with a foliar-applied PPO inhibitor, that may be completely ineffective if you have plants or populations that have evolved resistance to both glyphosate and the PPO inhibitors. And so then again, you know, you're looking at a fairly significant yield loss scenario if we're not able to adequately and timely control the water hemp populations in the crops.
We're talking with University of Illinois Extension weed scientist Aaron Hager today about resistant weed control in the 2016 growing season. I made note that in the third part of the series posted in the Bulletin website at bulletin.illinois.edu, or just search Google for Bulletin, University of Illinois Extension, and it will come up. In the third part of the series, you talk about effective weed control. What do you mean?
There's been quite a renewed interest for the last 2 to 4 years about using more than one herbicide to try to control some of the problematic species, in particular the resistant biotypes. And many times if you look at the herbicide products that are commercially available, there's many premix combinations that farmers can select from in either corn or soybean. Some of these are two-way premixes or three-way premixes, or even a premix that has four different herbicide active ingredients contained within it. So the idea of multiple versus effective, we really try to promote the effective or the use of effective herbicides, multiple effective herbicides against the resistant population. But you have to understand what makes up the premixes. Because even though a premix may have more than one herbicide active ingredient, it may have herbicides that represent more than one site of action within the plant, that doesn't mean that it's necessarily synonymous with having effective target sites. They say, for example, if you selected to use a soil-applied premix product that had a PPO inhibitor, a group 14 herbicide, combined with an ALS inhibitor or a group 2, and this was a strategy that you were trying to use multiple effective herbicides against an ALS-resistant water hemp population, the reality of it is that you do have multiple herbicides, but you have only one effective herbicide in that particular combination. And you need to think about this not only with your selection of soil-applied herbicides, But think of this also in your selection of post-applied herbicides, whether it be mixes or combinations that you can purchase as a premix, or that you do the tank mix combinations by themselves. And I'll give you another example of if you had a water hemp population that is resistant to glyphosate. If you elected to try to control that with a mixture, either a premixture or a tank mixture of glyphosate and dicamba, you do not have two effective sites of action in that application. You have only one.
Why is that the case?
If the glyphosate-resistant population is there, then glyphosate is no longer effective against it, and dicamba would be the only selective effective herbicide in that particular combination.
You know, last year, many farmers will say, well, it rained so much. Mm-hmm. I tried, and I used glyphosate, went over the top, just like normal. I'm fine with that. The rain just caused it not to be effective. I'm coming back anyway, because it's the most effective tool I think I have, and it's not only that, but it's also cost-effective. Mm-hmm. Is that the right thought?
It's probably not the right thought, simply because that the fact that resistance does not just manifest itself completely in 1 year. It's very likely that the year that it becomes very obvious that glyphosate or any other herbicide is not effective, you've had that population in place for, who knows, 2, 3, perhaps 4 or 5 years before that. And so it really depends upon how you want to define effective. If you've actually lost yield because of the weed populations that maybe a small percentage of the plants you haven't controlled in the past, now all of a sudden this year it manifests itself to where it's at a level that's very, very obvious to see, who knows what the yield loss potential could be.
Fine. I'll just use dicamba beans in that case.
Technology is right now not available to do that. Both the dicamba-resistant technology and the 2,4-D-resistant technology at this time, those traits have not received all of the export-import approvals that they would need, for example, into the Chinese marketplace. And then furthermore, as of the time that we're doing the interview, dicamba has not been labeled for applications to dicamba-resistant soybeans. So we're really cautioning people, if this is an idea, if this is a technology that farmers are really going to try to depend on in 2016, it would be very, very advisable to have a good integrated backup plan in case these technologies are not available in 2016.
Have you written one for me? Four steps?
Yes, we have. Actually, we've our last installment in considerations for 2016 would be to consider, in soybean especially, a technology that is available and will be available in ample supplies in 2016, and that is a glufosinate-resistant soybean, or the Liberty Link soybean system. And many times we've heard either custom applicators or farmers say, well, you know, that system is not as simple as the Roundup Ready system. And if you accept the fact that if you try to use Liberty like you do Roundup, it probably is going to fail as many times as it's going to be effective. We have to really think about how we're going to use a Liberty Link system. It's not that complicated, but it's not just the fact that we go and load up the spray tank with Liberty and go spray the beans in there and they're clean at the end of the year. Many times that would work, but the probability of having success with the Liberty Link system is much greater if we think about the entire system as a whole, beginning with planting time, selection of appropriate residual herbicides, timely post applications, and scouting that take place after the initial post. These are things that we have done before the widespread adoption of the glyphosate resistant technologies. We did these things. We did use residual herbicides, we did make timely post applications, and we did follow up scouting. So it's really nothing that we haven't done before. It's a lot of the things that we haven't been doing actively for the last several years, but they're things that if we do these, if we understand how we're going to use the Liberty Link traits and technology, it can be very, very effective against some of these resistant populations that we're dealing with right now and will be dealing with again in 2016.
Is this the only option? Because it sounds a bit like a commercial.
It's an option. If you don't have any resistance issues on your farm right now, you're in the best position. You can take a lot of these different traits, integrate them into your system, use multiple effective herbicides to try to slow the evolution of resistance on your particular field. As of right now, given the widespread occurrence that we see of multiple resistance in our water hemp populations to glyphosate and to the PPO inhibitors, if you had a population, in, let's say in soybean, where individual plants were resistant to both glyphosate and the PPO inhibitors, if you are in a Roundup Ready system, if you are in a conventional soybean system, you have no effective post-herbicides.
Thanks so much, Aaron.
You bet.
Aaron Hager is an extension weed scientist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. You can read his four-step program on the Bulletin website. I'll post a link into our own website at willag.org. Search Bulletin, by the way, on Google. Bulletin, University of Illinois Extension should be the first thing to come up. It's bulletin.ipm.illinois.edu. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason. Weed scientists have been trying to help farmers manage the inevitable development of herbicide resistance for more than two decades. There's now proof which advice actually works. Plants are quite capable, by the way, of evolving. Weeds like water hemp have evolved. These weeds are resistant to some of the herbicides used to control them. It was thought by many weed scientists this evolution would take place much more quickly with the overuse of any particular active ingredient. So extension specialists like Aaron Hager from the University of Illinois promoted the rotation of herbicides and modes of action. They didn't have proof this would work, but now they do, with qualifications.
We realized that there really were not a lot of empirical data to describe how effective these actually were on a very large landscape level. And so we undertook a project several years ago, it was started, to try to determine which may be some of the better recommendations that actually do slow this evolution, perhaps better than other recommendations would. And one specific one that we looked at was, okay, which might be more effective? Is it more effective for a farmer to rotate herbicides either within a given year or between years? Or is a more effective strategy yet to actually use tank mix combinations of herbicides every time an application is made?
Using the records of a retail applicator, the scientists poured through more than 500 site years' worth of field-level data. The final analysis included 66 variables for each of the fields surveyed for the presence or absence of glyphosate-resistant water hemp.
To make a long story short, what the analysis really showed was that the most important determination of whether or not glyphosate resistance was present in any particular field was the management.
The management of the field as a whole, not just as it related to glyphosate.
Really, the thing that was a bit surprising to us was the fact that simply rotating herbicides either within a year or perhaps even between years really did not have a positive effect on the occurrence of glyphosate resistance. As a matter of fact, by simply rotating one herbicide one year to another the next year, the incidence of resistance was actually higher compared with areas where we had used multiple effective tank mixtures for applications made to that particular population.
Aaron Hager concludes the best way to slow evolution of glyphosate-resistant water hemp is to expose any given population to more than one effective herbicide every time an application is made. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Support comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's Ag Programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at agrigold.com.
It's National French Fried Shrimp Day. In the U.S., shrimp harvesting was known as early as the 17th century in Louisiana, where bayou inhabitants used nets of up to 2,000 feet in circumference. By the way, it was not until 1917 that motorized boats used trawl nets to catch shrimp. On this day in agricultural history in 1620, Mayflower pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock on the western side of Cape Cod Bay. During the first winter, more than half of the settlers died as a result of poor nutrition and inadequate housing. But the colony survived due in part to Squanto, a native to the New World, who taught the pilgrims how to plant corn and where to fish and trap beaver. In 1773, Robert Brown was born. A Scottish botanist, he improved the natural classification of plants by establishing and defining new families. In 1829, the first stone arch railroad bridge in the U.S. was dedicated in Baltimore. Construction took over 9 months and involved some 1,500 tons of granite. Overall, the bridge stands 62 feet tall and is 300 feet long. In 1944, horse racing was banned in the U.S. until after World War II. And although it doesn't have much to do with agriculture, on this day in 1950, Bing Crosby's White Christmas topped the charts. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Support for WILL comes from Busey. With more than 145 years of experience, Busey understands the benefits healthy businesses provide the local economy. Busey, your dream, our promise.
When you leave the hallowed halls of Illinois.
You know, there's a story here at the University of Illinois.
There is just one thing you can't forget, my boy.
And it is a very true story.
It's an old established rule.
Our undergraduate library, the place where students go and study, our undergraduate library is built underground. And that happened for only one reason.
Oh, you can't throw shit on the corn. It'll die as sure as you're born. No, sir, we don't mess around. Now that berry's underground, because you can't throw shade on the corn.
Nope, you just can't throw shade on the corn in the Morrow Plots.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the story about the undergraduate library is the fact that it's actually built underground rather than above ground to reduce any impact of shade on the Morrow Plots.
That's agronomist Bob Dunker. He takes care of the Morrow Plots and says the undergraduate library isn't the only building adjusted downward to keep the sunshine on the corn. And it's all happened for good reason.
It really is a historical continuum, kind of a living museum. You know, it was established in 1876, and it's the longest continuous research plot in America, and actually has the longest continuous corn plot in the world that has been documented. And you know, over the series of that time, it's been pretty much managed very similar as far as rotational scheme and looking at the effects of both fertilizer and crop rotation on soil quality.
Well, the Morrow Plots, established in the mid-late 1800s, are just about as old as the University of Illinois itself. This land grant was established in 1867. The Morrow Plots were much bigger back then. Three of the original plots remain, says Bob Dunker.
You know, originally there were 10 plots in the Morrow Plots, and now there actually are three, plots 3, 4, and 5, and Plot 3 has been in continuous corn since 1876. You know, Plot 4 has been in a two-year rotation from 1876 until 1967, was in a corn-oats rotation, and then soybeans were swapped out for oats after that period to more closely reflect what our typical agriculture is for this day. And Plot 5 has always been in a three-year rotation. It still has oats. It's a corn-oats alfalfa rotation, and so that's our three-year rotation. You know, only every 6 years, because of the way the rotations occur, is it in continuous corn, and that's when we can actually measure the responses of the different treatments because we have a uniform crop.
The continuous corn plots, the plot that hasn't ever been seeded with anything other than corn, typically has the lowest yields. The three-year corn oats alfalfa rotation has the best long-term average yield. You can come see the Morrow Plots for yourself on the University of Illinois campus. They're just to the east of the underground undergraduate library. The Morrow Plots song, as performed by the other guys, they've been an a cappella group on campus since 1968. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.